This morning we're going to look at the book of Job and what it has to say for our faith today. Job is almost certainly not a historical character, but rather the book of Job seems to be written in order to answer the problem that believers in God have with innocent or undeserved suffering. The book of Job was probably written in about the 3rd or the 4th centuries BC, but it's actually set in the time of the patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, several centuries earlier. Now, we're told that Job lives in the town of Uz. We don't know where Uz was. It doesn't seem to have been in Israel. It may have been in Edom. The book of Job is made up of three parts. There's a short prologue, a long debate, and a very short epilogue. Now, Job was a blameless and an upright man. He was God-fearing, and he set himself against all wrongdoing. He was also a very wealthy man. He had 7 sons, 3 daughters, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, 500 asses, and many slaves. Now, we move into the court of heaven, and there God says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job and how good he is, a blameless and an upright man?" Now, I think the best way to look at Satan is a member of the heavenly court. We might think of him as a prosecuting counsel. And Satan replies to God, "If you take away from Job all his wealth, all his possessions, he won't be as God-fearing. Instead, he will curse you." And so God gives Satan permission to do this. And so Satan takes away all Job's sheep, camels, oxes, and asses, and also kills all his sons and daughters. Job, of course, is distraught, but he doesn't say a word against God, and he remains sinless. And so Satan comes back to God and he says, "Take away Job's good health, and then he'll curse you." And so God allows Satan to afflict Job with running sores from head to foot. Not only this, Job's wife says to Job, "Curse God and die." But Job tells his wife that she's a wicked fool, and he refuses to say a bad word against God. He remains sinless. Now, Satan raises for us and for Job the question of, why do we believe in God And why do we worship God? Do we do so because God is God, or because of all the benefits and the blessings that we have from God? And in the story of Job, it becomes clear that Job has faith in God because God is God, and not because of any rewards that he receives from God. But the same question is directed towards us. Do we have faith in God simply because God is worthy of that faith and worthy of our worship? Or do we do it because we think that if we have faith in God, we will be blessed and receive material rewards? Now, the story moves on, and we're introduced to Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Now, they haven't seen at first hand what's happened to Job, but they do know Job. And so when they come on the scene and they see Job, at first they don't recognize him. And they're terribly sorry for Job, and they weep for him, and they remain with him for 7 days in silent sympathy and friendship. And then the debate begins, and Job speaks. And Job, of course, declares himself to be an innocent sufferer. At first, he doesn't curse God, but rather he curses the day that he's born. But as the speeches go on, Job becomes angry with his circumstances and angry with God. He's angry with God, and he thinks of God as punishing him. When we read Job, this can let us know that when we suffer terribly, it's a natural reaction to be angry and to be angry with God. There's nothing wrong about it. But of course, in time, we need to come through that stage. Now, in the Old Testament, God's blessing was seen primarily as shown through a person's wealth, his good health, and having a large family, especially having sons. And in Old Testament times, there was no belief in the life after death. That comes later. And so Orthodox Jewish thinking was that God blessed the good and the God-fearing with material rewards, and God punished the wicked with suffering. Now, this is a position of Job's three friends. And Eliphaz argues, God rewards the righteous, he punishes the wicked, Job has suffered, and so Job must be a wrongdoer. Bildad argues from the character of God, and Bildad says, God is righteous, and a righteous God rewards the good and punishes the wicked. And so because Job is declaring himself an innocent sufferer, he's calling into question the character and the righteousness of God, which he shouldn't be doing. And Zophar repeats the same arguments and just says to Job, he's lucky that he hasn't suffered even more. Now, Job's reply to his three friends is, whatever you say to me, I know I'm innocent. I've done nothing wrong. I haven't deserved this suffering. And basically, he says to them that their thinking, and so Orthodox Jewish thinking, is far too simplistic, and it isn't always true. And so Job personifies the innocent sufferer. Now, Job's friends blame Job for his suffering. He must have done wrong. And when we suffer, often the temptation is to blame ourselves, other people, or God. But it could be that there isn't anyone to blame. We can blame ourselves and feel terribly guilty, but maybe we're not to blame. We can blame others, but maybe they too haven't done anything wrong. And we can blame God, but maybe that too is wrong. I can remember some years ago when I was a hospital chaplain speaking to a very devout and fundamentalist Christian who was a patient in hospital. And she said to me that she believed that God had sent her illness to teach her and to test her faith. And I said that I couldn't agree with her thinking. We didn't go into a long theological argument because that, for me, wasn't the job of a hospital chaplain. But I certainly didn't agree with her position. Because if you took her position to its logical conclusion, you could say that God caused terrible illnesses like cancer or multiple sclerosis. And surely that is against our basic belief in a loving and a good God. And so what I'm saying is that sometimes we can't blame anyone for our suffering. Of course, there are occasions when we can blame someone. If an innocent pedestrian is injured or killed by a drunken driver, there's obviously someone to blame. If an innocent householder is robbed of his possessions and his money, well, there's a burglar to blame. But is there anyone to blame when a good young person is afflicted by cancer? Is there anyone to blame when a good family loses their home in an earthquake? Sometimes we simply have to say we don't know why things happen. In Job chapter 28, we're told that We know where to find silver and iron in the earth, but we don't know where to find in the earth wisdom. And then the chapter goes on to say that knowledge and understanding come from God. The fear of the Lord is wisdom, and to turn from evil is understanding. And so we can say that we can begin to know where to find wisdom and understanding. We can go to God for it, and there we will find some wisdom and understanding. Now, eventually the debate between Job and his friends Eliphaz, Bildad and Zophar come to an end. And another character appears on the scene, Elihu. He's a much younger man, and largely he repeats the arguments of his three predecessors. Job doesn't even deign to reply. Finally, we come on to the climax of the book of Job, chapter 38 onwards. And here, God appears out of the whirlwind. And one of the things to remember is whirlwinds have calm centres. And it's out of the whirlwind that God answers Job. Now, Job is wanting from God answers. But read Job 38, because all Job gets is questions. God says to Job, "I will ask questions, you shall answer. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you know and understand." And then God continues to bombard Job with questions. "Have you comprehended the vast expanse of the world? Did you determine the laws of nature on earth? Did you give the horse his strength?" And on and on. And finally we come to Job chapter 42 and Job's response. And Job says to God, "I know that thou canst do all things. I have spoken of things too wonderful for me to know, things too great for me to understand." And so what Job is saying to us is that there's an element of mystery in faith. He's saying that our knowledge and our understanding are very limited. When I was minister of St. John's United Reformed Church in Ipswich, one of the things I used to do was every Friday evening, I went with a friend, Keith, to play badminton. And I did this one Friday. Now, Keith was a very nice man. He was in his 50s. He was a retired policeman. And the next Monday, I saw Keith in hospital, and he had a very bloated stomach. I was shocked. About a week later, I was told that Keith had cancer, and I was even more shocked and distressed. A few months later, Keith died, leaving a wife and two grown-up children. Why such a good man as Keith should die like that, I simply do not know. I believe in a God of love. I believe that God raised Jesus Christ from the dead. And I believe in a life after death. And so I trust that Keith is safe in God's loving arms. There is a mystery about our faith. Our knowledge and our understanding are limited. We are called to have faith in God, but let's acknowledge that there's an element of mystery about our Christian faith. Amen.